It's Monday, June 30th, and it's 4:20 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Welcome back to the Daily Audio Stash. Glad to have you along today. We've got some great interviews, music, and news headlines for you to check out today. We're going to start by speaking with Jed Reif, who's the director of a new documentary called Waiting to Inhale that chronicles the rise of medical marijuana from the beginning of California's Prop 215. So stay tuned for that. Also, we're speaking with Loretta Nall from Alabama, who's going to tell us about a story that's not getting a lot of coverage, the story of a prominent judge's son who's busted on multiple felony drug counts and the special treatment he is receiving. So stay tuned for that. Also, we've got a stupid stoner story for you and some music in our musical break for this Blues Monday featuring Corey Harris and a song called the 5-0 Blues. Also, don't forget that ending adult marijuana prohibition starts with you. You need to get politically active. Get on the phone and call your Congress at 202-224-3121 and let them know how you feel about this drug war and ending adult marijuana prohibition. All right, everybody, sit back and relax with your favorite strain and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Alabama judge's son gets special treatment for felony drug bust. This reporting, courtesy of Loretta Nall with Alabamians for Compassionate Care. You can follow more about this story at her blog, nallforgovernor.blogspot.com. On March 3rd, 2008, John Alexander Rochester, son of 40th Circuit Court Judge John Rochester, was arrested at the Ashland City Park in Ashland, Alabama, for possession of meth, first-degree possession of marijuana, trafficking cocaine, possession of paraphernalia, distribution of a controlled substance, and possession of a controlled substance. Judge Rochester is legendary for harshly sentencing drug offenders who are unfortunate enough to find themselves in his courtroom. And Judge Rochester always drug tests defendants before the trial. He lines them up like cattle and demands their bodily fluids in hopes of bypassing that pesky thing known as a trial by jury. Judge Rochester doesn't believe in drug treatment before prison. In fact, one of his favorite sayings is, there's a SAP program in prison, whenever a lawyer asks that their client be allowed to attend treatment. SAP stands for Substance Abuse Program. His son, John Alexander Rochester, spent 20 days in the Ashland jail and was then bonded out by his mother for a total of $20,000 and whisked away to treatment in Mississippi to await the next convening of the grand jury in Clay County. The judge who set the bonds is Judge George C. Simpson, the district court judge in Clay County, which means he is subordinate to Judge Rochester and good friends with him to boot. In at least two cases, John Alexander Rochester's bond was half or less than what other people charged with the same crime had to pay. Additionally, John Alexander Rochester should have enhancements added to his sentence because he was selling drugs at the city park. The only catch is that the prosecutor has to ask that these additional penalties be imposed. And the reason that I have to post edited portions of an email sent to me by Loretta, rather than linking and pasting from an Alabama media story on John Alexander Rochester, is because the media in Alabama have all but been silent on the story of a prominent judge's son being busted near children in a park on multiple felony charges involving trafficking and three different drugs. HBO documentary, Ganja Queen. Tonight is the premiere of the HBO Documentary Films presentation of Ganja Queen. The movie tells the story of Chappelle Corby, who I've detailed before on The Stash. Corby was landing in Bali on a flight from Australia when airport officials discovered 9 pounds of marijuana in her bags. Corby claims the marijuana was not in her bag when she left Australia. The defense claims she was the victim of an airport smuggling ring that used unsuspecting passengers' bags. A smuggler working in baggage at the Australian airport would put the marijuana in the bag, and a smuggler working in baggage in Bali would offload the marijuana from the bag. There was even testimony from a Bali prisoner who claims to have overheard two other prisoners discussing how they botched a similar smuggling assignment from Australia to Bali. But the Indonesian courts aren't very forgiving of drug crimes. Smugglers and dealers can be given the death penalty. Prosecutors wanted the courts to sentence Corby to life in prison. Instead, for smuggling 9 pounds of marijuana into Bali, she was sentenced to 20 years in prison, where she still sits today.
I don't like drugs, and I know there is a big penalty in Indonesia if you have drugs. I thought, it's going to be fine. I said, what's going to happen? She said, it's death.
People believe that she's innocent, and people think this could have happened to my daughter.
Try and find evidence. No one seems to be trying to find who put the bloody stuff in the bag.
Chappelle Corby's father has admitted he was caught with drugs at a similar age that, like her, says the cannabis wasn't mine.
I'm thinking to myself, can she possibly be that good of an actor?
Just for comparison's sake, I thought you'd also like to know that the same month that Indonesian courts were sentencing Chappelle Corby to 240 months in prison for 9 pounds of marijuana, they were also sentencing Muslim cleric Abu Bakar Bashir for his role in the 2002 Bali nightclub bombing blasts that killed 202 people. The Indonesian court upheld his sentence of 30 months. Got that? Conspire to kill hundreds and you get 2.5 years. Smuggle pounds of pot, you get 20 years. Australia to allow New South Wales farmers to grow hemp. New laws will allow New South Wales farmers to grow cannabis crops for industrial use, the state government says. But the hemp plants will not be varieties containing any significant amount of the active substance in illicit cannabis. The hemp industry bill will allow farmers to grow hemp for use in skincare products, paint, load-bearing masonry, insulation, and as an additive to wood, Primary Industries Minister Ian MacDonald said. Such production is already permitted in Victoria, Tasmania, Queensland, the Australian Capital Territory, and Western Australia. The New South Wales Department of Primary Industries would work with farmers to make sure crops were only grown under a license by applicants of good repute, Mr. MacDonald said. The licensing system would stop industrial hemp being used as a camouflage for the marijuana variety of hemp, which contains a high concentration of the illicit cannabis drug THC, he said. The legislation would pave the way for a potentially lucrative industrial hemp industry, providing farmers with the additional option of another fast-growing summer crop, Mr. MacDonald said. Yet another sensible government allowing its people to grow non-drug cannabis. Yet another place overseas for our American dollars to flow to fulfill the domestic demand for hemp products that our struggling family farmers aren't allowed to grow. And interestingly, yet another scenario where ignorant politicians don't realize you can't use industrial hemp to camouflage consumer cannabis because the hemp will cross-pollinate the cannabis and ruin its potency, and the cannabis will cross-pollinate the hemp and ruin its fiber potential.
Stupid Stoner Stories. As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
A non-funding demand was charged by Greensburg State Police with possession of marijuana at a Dairy Queen. Calvin Maston, age 18, ordered several hamburgers through the Dairy Queen drive-thru window. After receiving the burgers, he allegedly placed a baggie of marijuana inside the takeout bag. Police say the man eventually realized his order was not correct and, forgetting that he placed the marijuana in the bag, went inside the restaurant and returned his order to get the correctly prepared hamburgers. When counter personnel saw the bag of marijuana, they contacted police.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
There's lots of great cannabis movies coming out, and some of them might be the Harold and Kumar type entertainment movies, but you got to have your vegetables along with your dessert, and that means you need to be watching some documentaries too to feed your mind and feed your head with the important information all of us cannabis crusaders need to know. I'm joined now by Jed Reif, who's the director of one of these such films, a film called Waiting to Inhale, and you can find out all about it at waitingtoinhale.org. Jed, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash.
Great. Thank you for having us.
All right. So you're directing this film, and this is a film about the medical marijuana movement, and it pretty much chronicles the rise and the success of the medical marijuana movement. Is that correct?
Yes. We've really, for over 5.5 years, we've followed it, and the film has been edited 3 times. We actually came out with a fine cut back in 2004 and then have re-updated it twice since then so that it makes it very current because, you know, it's kind of, everything has been evolving slowly over time here.
And who are some of the people that you've gotten into this documentary?
Well, you know, I think one of our favorite people groups is WAM, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Santa Cruz. You know, we kind of see Valerie and Mike Corral as not only did they help write Proposition 215, but what WAM offers its members, its cooperative, is some of the best services available. You know, they provide medical marijuana for 250 terminally ill patients for about $30,000 a year. So patients can get medicine that they need for free each week, and they also get a really strong support group. And that's an incredible model. And, you know, Valerie's gone on to create her own a hospice, an in-home hospice for these patients. You know, I think their group also really makes the case about how medical marijuana really is reaching seriously ill patients. When we started filming, there was, since when we started filming 2001 to when we stopped filming at the end of 2006, 119 of the 250 patients had died.
Wow.
And when we show the film at WAM or in related groups or where members of WAM see it, you can just really see the impact because there's all these faces that are now gone.
Yeah, it is a sad story to tell sometimes, and you do a great job of telling this story. I think you did also an excellent job of bringing in some of the counter arguments, you know, aside from the drug-free parents and all of that. How were you able to get these folks? Did you let them know it was a documentary in support of marijuana, or did they have any reservations about appearing in the film?
Well, I didn't, you know, intend to make the film, quote, for in support of medical marijuana. What I just tried to do was to tell the story, and part of it was actually an investigation of whether medical cannabis really worked. I had been on the board of an AIDS foundation back in the late 1980s, and at that time, AIDS was a death sentence. And, you know, the only thing, one of the things we did was try to help people find some dignity and help die with, you know, some love and support around them. And if they needed something, whatever it might be, whether it was a dinner or bringing their family out, or in some cases it was medical marijuana to help them eat because they couldn't eat and they were dying of the wasting disease, you know, we did that. And so when Prop 215 was passed, I wanted to see whether it really worked. And I went to Dr. Abrams and asked him, and he said that he would tell me and let me know and give me exclusive access to film if he got permission to film. And he did. I mean, ultimately, he got permission to do studies, and we were able to film.
Oh, that's great.
And so that balancing that to see whether it did work with going out to find out who was the leading opponents of medical marijuana, and we met many of them at the court of the Supreme Court when we followed the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative case to Washington, D.C., and we followed Jeff Jones and Yvonne Westbrook, an MS patient who is a member of the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, now the Patient ID Center. And, you know, we that case was so significant, we thought we really wanted to follow it. And there, on the steps, protesting, was a whole group of people associated with the National Families in Action and what was later to become the Parent Corps. And they were calling themselves Mothers Against Marijuana, Mothers Against Medical Marijuana. And Ginger Katz, Courage to Speak Foundation, she had lost her son to an heroin overdose. And Ginger is honestly convinced that it was smoking cannabis and drinking a little beer that got her son involved in drugs and then led to his overdose on heroin.
Right.
And we didn't feel like we should treat these people as, you know, kind of stick characters and knock their knees out under them if they made assumptions that we didn't agree with. We felt that they had real honest concerns, whether we agreed with them or not. And that's what we went to them with and tried to and discussed that with them, that we wanted to present their case without bias.
And I think you did a really fair job of that. You were treated to the subjects very fairly and let them make their case without any sort of mocking tone to it or anything like that. But, you know, coming from my perspective, of course, I see the film as a pro-medical marijuana film. But that, again, that's, again, my perspective on it because, well, because I'm pro-medical marijuana. I guess the beauty's in the eye of the beholder sort of situation there. Now, as far as this documentary goes, you've been screening it at a few of the different festivals and such. What has been the reaction from the public to your documentary?
Well, we've had an incredible reaction, not only here in the United States and Canada and across the world where it's been shown. We've won film festivals in Spain and been featured in Australia and Chile. And we've been able to not only play traditional film festivals, but also major international conferences like the International Harm Reduction Conference in Barcelona this year, where Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance and Marsha Rosenbaum represented us at this event and discussed the film with harm reduction specialists from all over the world. You know, we've also had it shown at the International Drug Policy Alliance here in the United States. And then we've done a series of targeted screenings, both at Summit Film Festivals and then tied that in with organizing in, say, in New Mexico with Rena and the folks who got the law passed there, so that we were able to start out at film festivals, then go to commercial screenings, then go and use it for grassroots organizing and to show the legislators and the staff of the legislators in the state of New Mexico. And Rena, who ran that campaign for DPA, said that our film was a very important asset in making getting that law passed.
If we have
Bill Richardson signing it,
I was going to say if we have any activists out there in the audience that are listening, how can they get in touch with you and be able to use this film in their efforts?
Well, if they go to waitingtoinhale.org, they can link into or get in contact to my website, and they can also get copies of the film. There's also a screening and discussion guide that's online, a PDF that they can download. But we really feel that we have tried to develop and work closely with like MPP, Americans for Safe Access, normal organizations, the Drug Policy Alliance, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, the Students for a Sensible Drug Policy, all these groups to try to target a state. For example, like in Illinois last year, we did 10 screenings in the state of Illinois from September to February. We were funded to do seven of those screenings, and the others we did with volunteer efforts. But it really was we were able to collaborate with the local organizing that was going on in the state to influence legislators But get in there in front of that and target the audience. So with the members in these different communities, such as Canton and Peoria, Bloomington Normal, Carbondale, Springfield, you know, we're really focusing on reaching grassroots people, local medical professionals, members of the clergy, and patients and the general public. And by doing that, by promoting those screenings and having enough funds to do it right, we were able to get 12 newspaper articles, 5 TV interviews, and 4 radio interviews.
Wow, that's excellent.
Really got people out to see the film.
Yeah, that is excellent. Now, are there any other plans for wider distribution, perhaps in more commercial theaters or maybe on cable somehow?
Well, we are working on getting the film on television right now, and that's one of our major goals. But we're continuing. We're working on an engagement campaign with the Sundance Documentary Fund. We were funded by Sundance, and only groups, films that were funded by them can apply. But I'm doing that, and then and that would give us additional funds and resources to tie in with current or with the project with what the 2009 strategic campaigns of MPP, ASA, and the other organizations are doing, and how they can use this film and use modules of the film. We're looking for funding right now to cut a module, say, for MS patients, another module that would be for AIDS patients. We have outtakes with Judith Kushner, who died of cancer recently, but who was one of the big organizers behind Prop 215 and who suffered from cancer, in interviews with her and her daughter and son. As she went through that horrible experience of having cancer, surviving it, and then ultimately dying, but how marijuana helped her. So we see that if we can create these kinds of things that people can also distribute among themselves and share, and we can reach family groups of MS patients and family groups of AIDS patients and AIDS clinical trial units, we think, you know, that's one of the important things is most people have never seen the information that's in this film. It's not shown on any television station in the United States. It's not been widely distributed except for these 54 screenings that we've done across the United States and around the world. And so we feel that if you don't have the information, how can you make informed decisions?
Absolutely.
And all that people see, you know, is propaganda footage and some footage that was shot back in 1998, 99 after the passage. And it's very stereotypical. And they really need to see real patients getting real relief with real scientific studies that document and back this up, like the ones that GW Pharmaceutical did, as done in Great Britain, and the ones that Dr. Donald Abrams did at UC San Francisco and UC San Diego.
I think I completely concur on that, because I think, you know, when we present the facts to the people in a dry scientific way, as far as the studies go, that's part of it, certainly. But when you hear that firsthand testimony from people like Irv Rosenfeld and some of the other patients in the film, where it's really hard to deny to someone to their face when they're telling you they're getting relief from the use of marijuana. And I think that really sells the concept much alongside the scientific studies. They go hand in hand. I think it's a great job.
And you know, Irvin is a really wonderful example. I mean, look, he's been getting marijuana for over 20 years from the federal government. He was the second patient behind Robert Randall, the late Robert Randall, who pioneered and who forced the United States government to recognize marijuana as a medicine. And you know, we're in this dual world where marijuana is six, seven people get marijuana from the federal government every month, 300 rolled marijuana cigarettes in a tin, and nobody else can, unless you're in a medical marijuana state. And then you're still subject to the laws of the federal government coming down on you. So, you know, I mean, but Irvin is a stockbroker. He works every day. He smokes 11 marijuana cigarettes every day, and he's able to do his work and volunteer with volunteer organizations that help other people with serious diseases. So he's really stands out as the kind of person that we think we should be holding up as an example.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic film, and like I say, I encourage everyone to check it out. The website is waitingtoinhale.org. We'll have links to that up at our blog at stash.normal.org. We've been speaking with the director, Jed Reif, by telephone. Jed, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We appreciate you and love to hear from any of your reader or listeners and see if we can work with them on campaigns in their local communities.
Absolutely. Get in touch with them at waitingtoinhale.org.
Hi, I'm Keith Straub, the founder of Normal. In all the years since 1970 that I've been fighting marijuana prohibition, I've learned that drug warriors love to confuse the public with statistics. Lately, they've claimed that there are more teens enrolled in drug treatment for marijuana than ever before. It's a statement that, while true, is intentionally misleading. What they don't tell you is that marijuana arrests have skyrocketed to over 800,000 arrests per year. They also don't tell you that we've gone from a few dozen drug courts in the 1990s to over 2,500 drug courts today. The kicker is that those drug courts sentence teens routinely to drug treatment for marijuana, whether they need drug treatment or not. So they arrest more people for pot, require them to enter drug treatment, then claim the higher treatment numbers justify more pot arrests. It's an absurd proposition, but no more absurd than banning a plant. Learn the facts about pot. Visit norml.org today.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Time for some more great blues on this Blues Monday. Today we get the track 5-0 Blues by Corey Harris. As cannabis consumers, we're always on the lookout for the police, or the 5-0, which is a slang term that comes from the old Hawaii 5-0 cop show from the 1970s. This tune takes you all the way down to the Mississippi Delta blues sounds of the New Orleans musicians, complete with traditional guitar and authentic Crescent City horn arrangements. You can find out more about Corey Harris and download more of his music at his MySpace page. We've got a link to that up at our blog at stash.normal.org, where you can also find a download link for the MP3 of this tune. It's Corey Harris with 5-0 Blues.
Try I'm Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. Have you heard about the new super pot that's supposedly 20 times more potent than your father's Woodstock weed? Don't believe the hype. Marijuana's THC potency has always varied, even in the 60s and 70s. And the drug czar's numbers are full of, well, exaggerations. While no intoxicant is harmless, cannabis is non-toxic and far safer than alcohol. No matter how much you smoke, of whatever potency, you cannot die of a marijuana overdose. Potency is irrelevant anyway. More potent pot just means you smoke less of it, meaning less harmful smoke in your lungs. This is a prime example of harm reduction in action. Besides, the government already allows the prescription of THC pills. Its commercial brand name is Marinol, and it's 100% potent. Meanwhile, the federal government won't allow dying people to use natural marijuana, no matter what the potency. Does this make sense to you? Learn the facts about pot. Visit NORML.org today.
Well, one of the areas where you have to pay a lot of attention in the drug war here is in the criminal justice system and the exorbitant and incredible fines and sentences that we are often victimized by in this drug war. I'm turning now to the Great American South, specifically the great state of Alabama, and we're joined by the Executive Director of Alabamians for Compassionate Care, Loretta Nall, is joining us on the telephone. Loretta, welcome back to the Daily Audio Stash.
Hey, Russ, thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Well, we've got one of these drug war cases that we need to talk about. You brought it to my attention through an email here, and I thought this was quite interesting. A young man who got some pretty serious charges here, trafficking of cocaine, possession of meth, possession of marijuana, pretty serious charges there. And apparently this guy isn't having to deal with the same sort of criminal justice repercussions that most of us would. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about this fella, John Alexander Rochester?
All right. John Alexander Rochester is from a tiny little town called Ashland, Alabama, which is also incidentally my hometown. He's the son of the circuit court judge there, John E. Rochester.
Ah.
He's an absolute tyrant when it comes to drug offenders. And back in March, the young Rochester, the son, was arrested at the city park in Ashland, where all the little children play on the monster truck and tractor toys and hang upside down from the monkey bars. He was arrested for trafficking cocaine and first-degree possession of marijuana, meth, and distribution, and all the things that you just mentioned. I was really shocked that the Ashland police arrested him, so I have to give them my hats off for that. They did not discriminate when it came to it being the judge's son. He went to jail in Ashland for 20 days. And then he was bonded out by his mother for a total whopping $20,000 for all of these charges. The judge who set his bonds is the district court judge in the 40th Circuit in Clay County, who is subordinate to his father and really good friends with his father.
Hmm.
And he set his bonds way, way lower than anyone else's, kind of during the same time frame on similar charges. I've got six case action summaries from the Rochester case, and then five other ones from other people at the same time. And he was allowed to be bonded out and go to Mississippi to a treatment center and await the grand jury convening later on this year.
Now, what would his conditions here be? Let's say it's not the judge's son; it's just the average person in Alabama busted under these same sort of circumstances. What would they be looking at for bond here?
You'd probably be looking at no bond.
Oh.
I've sat in Judge Rochester's courtroom many times as an observer, as a family member of a defendant. I've got two brothers who are, you know, class A fuck-ups. God love them. They're sweet as they can be, but they just get in a lot of trouble. So I've been in the courtroom a lot, and he once sent a kid that I grew up with and went to church with to prison for 5 years for possession of one Xanax without a prescription. The kid had no priors. I mean, he came from a good family, never been in trouble. And he was actually in prison with one of my brothers. And then I was in court one day, not too long ago. It was in January of 2007. And I saw a truck driver go up who got 5 years for simple possession of methamphetamine, went straight to prison, sent him straight to Kilby. Judge Rochester likes to line everybody up against the wall that's there, you know, for trial or for, you know, a hearing if they've been in jail or whatever, and make them, you know, take a drug test before he even hears their cases. So He also doesn't believe in substance abuse treatment before prison. So there's a SAP program in prison is his favorite line when a lawyer will ask if their client can be allowed to attend treatment while awaiting trial. So, you know, Judge Simpson, I'm not sure how he sentences people. I don't have a lot of experience with him, but Rochester's, you know, the son or the father of the guy who's in so much trouble. So it's like the perfect storm. And, you know, there's been a media blackout, basically. I'm the only one reporting it. And none of the other, you know, news outlets in and around the area seem interested at all. It's just absolutely amazing.
Let me just break that down. We've got the son of a judge arrested with marijuana, coke, and meth in a city park near kids, getting the kid glove treatment here as far as not, you know, being bonded out at a much lower rate or even just being bonded out at all. And none of the Alabama media is covering this?
None of it. Actually, I wrote the Clay Times Journal, which is the, you know, the small local weekly paper there. And I've been writing them for about 2 weeks and not getting a response. And so today the story got picked up on Reddit and went to, like, the top of the list. So they're getting a lot of traffic. And so today they finally decided to respond, and they said they actually did write a story about it, but they didn't have a website up and running then. And when they got done with this week's edition, they would dig up the story and send it to me. So other than that, there's been no mention of this at all. The only way that I knew about it was because I knew some people that were in jail with the Rochester kid when he was in there. There's some interesting things that I haven't posted on the internet that I'd like to mention a little bit. Since I started raising hell about this, one of my brothers and his wife got in some more trouble at the same time that this was going on. They were both in jail. My brother was Dry County. My brother was there for violation of prohibition law. He had an empty beer can in the bed of a truck he was driving, so he got, you know, wrapped up on that. My sister-in-law, his wife, she's a chronic pain patient who doesn't have health insurance, and so she has to get medications in other ways. She got popped with like a handful of Meprigan, which is a major felony. And they were in jail at the same time that the Rochester kid was in jail, and I started writing about this on my blog. And suddenly, my brother was released with time served. He's been out of prison less than a year. He got out last September. And after 4 months, Judge Rochester allowed my sister-in-law to bond out. All she got sentenced to was 28 days in rehab. And so, this is completely off the charts for him. And nobody, you know, I have to wonder, you know, if it wasn't because I started writing. But I want to say that I don't want special treatment for my family members. I want equal treatment for everybody, either in this nonsense or treat everybody the same way.
Yeah, if we had more of the judges' kids and more of the high-profile cases getting the same treatment as, say, the average African-American youth from Birmingham or something, we would have a big change in this drug war, I would think.
It would change overnight, Russ.
Yeah.
Overnight.
So where can people find more about this story? Give them your blog address so that they can follow this up and raise some hell about it.
It's nallforgovernor.blogspot.com. It's one of the top two stories on there, so just scroll down until you find it.
Yeah, we'll put a link up on the Stash blog, too, at stash.normal.org. Has there been any reaction or ink on the judge himself? Has he come out and said anything?
He has said nothing. He's just been silent. Like I said, there haven't been any interviews. There's been no investigative, you know, journalism, no media to, you know, to put him in the spotlight and ask him what's going on. So, no, I mean, he's been completely, you know, unmolested by the media, unlike the rest of us. When we get, you know, wrapped up, we get our names in the paper, we're on the 5 o'clock news.
Yeah.
And, you know, your whole hometown knows about you. And so, but they have really, it's like they've thrown up a protective wall around him. It's just really disgusting.
Yeah. Now, the charges that he's gotten here, and I want to look at the prosecution side of this. He's charged with possession of methamphetamine, Class C felony, possession of paraphernalia, misdemeanor, distribution controlled substance, Class B felony, possession of controlled substance, Class C felony, possession of marijuana, Class C felony, trafficking cocaine, Class A felony. So a lot of these felonies here, and it's absurd enough as it is and shocking enough as it is that it's not getting any ink and he's not getting any real punishment for this. But also, you mentioned he was at a park, a public park. Don't we have, aren't there charges to add to that for, you know, within 100 feet of a school or something like that?
In Alabama, it's actually within 3 miles.
Oh, my God, 3 miles. Okay.
So Ashland is so tiny that everything is within 3 miles. And so on the blog where I have this posted, I have a map, and it shows he was arrested at the park. you know, you can walk probably 500 yards from the park and there's a Head Start daycare center. Across the street is, you know, a public housing facility. Five or six blocks the other way is the elementary school and high school. You just simply can't, I mean, right there. And so it should be, he should have enhancements added, you know, 5 years for selling within, you know, for distribution, for possession, within all of those. But the trick is the prosecutor has to ask for those to be added.
Oh.
And the prosecutor in this little small town is also really good friends with the judge. And, you know, I don't believe you can get a prosecutor removed from a case. I don't know. I know that you can a judge. You can ask for him to recuse himself. But I don't know if there's a process for asking that a new prosecutor be appointed because, you know, even if we got it moved out of the county, if you've got the same prosecutor, there's no way he's going to, you know, his intentions aren't going to be as pure as the driven snow to slam the kid like they are with everybody else who gets his paws on. So,
yeah, we definitely need to raise a stink about this. I'm going to encourage all of our listeners out there to write to your media outlets. Let's get a hold. Let's get ABC News. Let's get all the major news outlets on this and maybe make a national story of this to just highlight the disparity in how we treat the well-connected and the rich in the war on drugs versus all the rest of us.
Oh, thanks, Russ. I really appreciate it. I hope that people will, you know, jump on and put this out there. Because we, you know, sometimes instead of hating the media, you have to be the media, such as you do there at normal podcast. And we have to be our own media and until the media, you know, the mainstream picks up on it, as much as we hate the mainstream sometimes, you know, it's really important to try and engage them, especially when there's something like this going on that's not getting any coverage.
The website is nallforgovernor.blogspot.com. That's N-A-L-L for F-O-R. governor.blogspot.com. We'll have links at the Stash blog at stash.normal.org. We're speaking with Loretta Nall, who is the executive director of Alabamians for Compassionate Care. Loretta, thanks for informing us and keeping up on this story.
Thanks, Russ, for having me on, and, you know, smoke on, normal folks.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one from Anne Shulgin, Ph.D., therapist and author. Quote, "Several generations of high school students have grown up ignoring and disbelieving everything they've heard from government and police about drugs, including information that was factual and valid, because they discovered for themselves that most of what has been taught to them was simply not true." End quote. And that may be the worst aspect of this war on marijuana. When we tell people that marijuana is so much more harmful than it really is, it leads them to disbelieve the true harms of the other drugs that they encounter. Let's give our teenagers the factual information about marijuana and tax and regulate it so that we can control the sales and distribution. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here at the Daily Audio Stash. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. I've got a special essay on the 35th birthday of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.